The State Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training. Today is part two of our three-part series on LNAPLs, LNAPL conceptual site models, and the LNAPL decision process. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to quickly cover the introductory material on today's class, and then I'm going to turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC guidance document. We're going to introduce you to the guidance during today's class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. The trainers control the slides in Adobe Connect. If you'd like to, you can control your own slides by downloading the presentation, and that's back on that Clue-In training page where we started today. In the bottom right, we have our Q&A pod. You are welcome to send in questions anytime throughout today's class. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with an answer. In other cases, we're going to ask those questions out loud during our question and answer breaks. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes at the end of the class to fill out the form. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So if that's something you're interested in, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that certificate is by completing the feedback form. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. We include our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use the ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We have our online and classroom schedule for all of 2018 available. And there's more opportunities for you to become involved in ITRC. More information about our trainers is on the trainers bio, which are available from that Clue-In training page where you started today. We also included the link here at the bottom of the slide. Our trainers today are Tom Fox at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety, Andrew Kirkman at BP, Eric Gessert at Terracon, and John Smith at AECOM. I'll now turn the presentation over to Tom Fox at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Tom?
Thanks, Juliana. You can hear me, correct?
Yes.
Okay, we have a little over 200 people joining us today, which is great. I'd like to welcome you to part two of the ITRC LNAPL training series. We assume everyone attended part one, and we're going to be quickly moving into part two here shortly. We just want to remind you to visit the ITRC website, as Juliana has mentioned, and you can use the updated web-based document that's there. This guidance can be used for any LNAPL site, regardless of its size or the site use. So here's kind of what's new with the LNAPL document. We've expanded the LNAPL key concept section and updated that. We've also developed the LNAPL conceptual site model section and made it more complete. We've put more of an emphasis on identifying SMART objectives, and we'll be talking about that today. And also, we've expanded the LNAPL transmissivity and also natural source zone depletion sections with appendices. Our learning objectives for the three-part series are here. Part one, we covered last week, and basically we reviewed and updated the LNAPL science. And this is really important for you to understand and use at your sites, or really everything else you're going to learn is going to be pretty useless. Part two we're going to be covering today, we're going to be developing the LNAPL conceptual site model, I'll just call it the LCSM, to identify LNAPL concerns. We're also going to be establishing appropriate LNAPL remedial goals and specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound, or SMART, objectives for these concerns. We also want to inform stakeholders of the capability and limitations of various LNAPL remedial technologies. And part three we're going to be covering next week, but very briefly, next week we'll be covering how to select remedial technologies to achieve the objectives, how to prepare for transitioning between different LNAPL strategies or technologies as the site moves through investigation and cleanup, and then we're going to smartly measure progress toward an identified technology-specific endpoint. The main takeaway from part one is that our knowledge and understanding of LNAPL behavior has really evolved. We should all use that knowledge to improve our decision-making at release sites. Key points from last week, just to hit a couple highlights, are that LNAPL does not sit like a pancake on the water table, contrary to a lot of thoughts out there. LNAPL in a well does not mean the LNAPL is migrating or even recoverable. LNAPL transmissivity is a better indicator of recoverability than the apparent thickness in a well. LNAPL may be present in the subsurface even if it's not in monitoring wells, and it can cause long-term compositional concerns that we'll have to deal with. And finally, biological processes play a really large role in LNAPL depletion, and these processes really have not been appreciated until recently. So basically, just to summarize, it's important that you use LNAPL science and apply it to make really good decisions for your site. Our three-part training series focuses on helping you to connect science to the LNAPL site management. This is covered in Section 3 of the LNAPL document. Part 2 we're going to be covering today, as I mentioned, is going to be working on your LNAPL CSM, and that's covered in Sections 4 and 5 of the document. And next week we'll be working on selecting and implementing LNAPL remedies, and that'll be covered in Section 6 of the document. This training is going to be incomplete unless you then apply this information. And after this training, we expect that you'll be able to use the decision-making that you're going to learn here today and next week at your LNAPL sites. And for any of you regulators like me, you should look at ways that you can incorporate ITRC guidance into your own guidance. Today, in part two, we're going to be asking, do you know where the LNAPL is and how to address LNAPL concerns? In relation to the process flow diagram in the LNAPL document, this section outlined in pink is a section we'll be covering today. Today we're going to be showing how to develop a living CSM, one that's constantly updated, and how that enables you to make better LNAPL remediation and management decisions. We're going to be discussing key LNAPL and site data that's useful for the model, when and why those data may be important, and how to effectively organize the data into an LCSM. And secondly, we're going to be discussing how to develop a site strategy using the LCSM to identify and classify concerns, establish remedial goals to address the concerns, and also develop remediation objectives. We had a poll question up earlier. The question was, thanks Juliana, the question was, the projects I work on are limited by, and you get to choose the best answer, and you could choose several if you wanted to, but it's important to note here that two-thirds of you chose technical constraints as one of the limitations that you face in your work. About a quarter of you also chose budget constraints. Very few people chose time, interestingly. But what's really important here is that it shows how important it is understanding the geology and having a really good LCSM is to all of us. So at this point, I'd like to introduce Andrew Kirkman. He's with BP, and he's going to help us begin developing the initial LCSM for a site.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, so, related to the poll, just it's interesting. One of the things here is that when dealing with time constraints, I found that that often drives the, might say riskiest or you get a higher chance of implementing a technology that may not be effective because we don't have time to fully evaluate whether or not it's going to work. So, you know, it's worthwhile to note that that one is not generally high, but it does occur, and that's something to watch out for there. So as Tom said, you know, we're going to be updating the LCSM continually, and when we talk about that, I often hear concerns around, well, eventually we need to move out of characterization. Or You know, does it mean I just keep putting borings in between my existing points for more resolution? But it's really related to a decision-making process, and that there's different data that's needed for different decisions throughout the remedial process. And in this flowchart, we have initially our initial LCSM, and that's primarily to identify the LNAPL concerns, ask ourselves questions like, do we feel confident that we have sufficient information to identify what those concerns are and verify them with threshold metrics, which we'll talk about, and establish remedial goals. Then there's going to be different information for the remedy selection LCSM that we'll want to focus on in order to choose effective remedy. Then the design and performance LCSM, once again, there might be some more finer resolution data for a specific technology that we want in order for that design for well spacing or waste management, waste treatment. But also, more as importantly, what are those performance metrics that are going to tell us what's going on in the subsurface? While our remedial goal may be to reduce dissolved phase concentrations down gradient, groundwater may take years to migrate 200 feet. So what's going to be informing us that our remediation is working in the source area, and what are those metrics? Another way to look at this, which we've simplified this a little bit, is that the update or the evolution of the LCSM, it occurs in parallel with decision-making processes. You know, our initial stage is the initial LCSM to identify those concerns. What issues do we have at the site? The next phase is making sure we have the right information to understand how to address that concern. And the last one, as I talked about, was the design and performance LCSM. And ensuring we have the right performance metrics to monitor the efficacy of our remediation activities, optimize and confirm that this is the right technology. So we're going to first talk about the LNAPL concerns LCSM. What does it include? First, the goal of it is to identify the LNAPL concerns, whether it's risk and safety, is that source LNAPL source stable or migrating? Is there mobile LNAPL in wells? Have we met maximum extent practicable? Or other, which might be sheens or geotechnical considerations. So the initial LCSM, I always look at this as it's fairly well developed. We're pretty good at identifying what is the problem. But our recent improvements in this area, such as ITRC's PVI guidance with screening distances, natural source zone depletion, specifically how natural source zone depletion relates to plume stability. Understanding that that's one of the factors playing a role there is a fairly large step change. LNAPL transitivity to understand the recoverability, and sheens as well. And ongoing development includes the TPH guidance currently being developed by ITRC. So for the initial LCSM, we've developed a completeness test. Typically, the CSM should be able to inform a series of questions that we've identified. The amount of detail, though, for a given question is decided by asking, do I feel comfortable in knowing what my concerns are? Are there any uncertainties there, rather than a specific recipe? So the initial LCSM, you know, things that are included in there, rather than saying you need five wells or wells spaced this many feet, we're looking at concepts like we need to understand where those receptors are. We need to understand the extent of impacts, and is that plume LNAPL body stable or migrating? LNAPL occurrence in wells is often a regulatory-driven need related to maximum extent practicable. However, hydraulic conductivity is one of those parameters that is not consistently needed. We have a small site. We've delineated the dissolved phase impacts. They're contained on site, and the plume is stable. there may not be a driver for remediation beyond MNA and NSED, in which case we've identified our concerns with the existing data. We understand that the LNAPL is there, and hydraulic conductivity isn't needed. However, if we were to move to remediation and we wanted to understand how hydraulic recovery would affect this, we want to extract water, we may need hydraulic conductivity then for understanding the water production rate. And so hydraulic conductivity is often something that's needed as a remediation design parameter, more so than to identify what those concerns are. Another site, though, may require hydraulic conductivity. If it's a recent release and we believe the dissolved phase plume is expanding, we may want to do Thetan transport modeling where hydraulic conductivity is an input parameter. And similarly, distribution of LNAPL within the extent of impacts. It's not consistently required to identify what the concerns are, but there are those cases where in order to further evaluate plume stability or preferential pathways, it might be required in the initial LCSM. So the questions that have been developed around this are typical of multiple guidance documents, including ASTM, CRC CARE, IPCA, and EPA. They were developed to encourage a systematic framework to develop the LCSM, also to promote discussions between stakeholders. You know, is that CSM sufficient or is it incomplete? What specifically do we need to focus on? These list of questions, each one of these is described in the document. We're not going to go over the individual ones today, but just really talk about the process due to time limitations. And the top in the green is really typical of any CSM, whether it's hydrocarbon related or not. Whereas as we get down to number 10, the questions become more and more LNAPL specific. The amount of knowledge for a given question is related to the complexity of the site. And this diagram here has been adapted from several documents. ASTM conceptual model documents as well as other publications. And on the y-axis here is really the subsurface factors. How complex is the subsurface? Are we in bedrock? Is the soil homogeneous, heterogeneous? Do we have one release or multiple releases of different LNAPL types? And as that increasing complexity drives us further and further up on the y-axis, we increase in the of the LCSM, which means increasing LCSM complexity, data density, lines of evidence. Additionally, the x-axis represents site set or physical factors. How many receptors do we have and where are they located? Do we have ground structures? Are there business and community factors to consider as well as preferential pathways? And the more higher complexity drives us to saying, well, we're going to answer the same questions that were on the last slide, but we're going to do it with more lines of evidence for those specific questions because it's more complex and we need a higher level of confidence. Here are two example sites, a tier one retail where we have diesel and sand, 10 to 15 feet to water table, a dissolved phase plume is contained on site via M&A. Mobile LNAPL exists in wells at 1 foot square per day transmissivity. LNAPL is not under any buildings, and the release occurred 10 plus years ago with several years of monitoring data. We have fairly well-defined concerns. We have a small LNAPL body, we do not have risk to receptors. Transmissivity is above 0.8 feet square per day, but close to it. You know, it's really at a point where we understand our concerns and, you know, it's a point where we can move on to understanding what do we need to do to address those concerns. Whereas tier three retail, gasoline and interbedded soil overlying bedrock. Our water table is at 15 to 20 foot depth. We have fractured bedrock at 25 foot depth and a down gradient receptor that has a 30-year-old well that's screened in bedrock and it exhibits impacts. The LNAPL is known to be outside in the unconsolidated soil. This is a site where simply delineating the LNAPL body may not be sufficient to identify specific concerns. Well, while the receptor is impacted, are they impacted because there is dissolved phase impacts migrating in the bedrock aquifer too well, or is it because the offsite elnapple intersects their well and the age of the well may have a compromised annular space, which is allowing vertical migration of impacts through the annular space to the screened interval. You know, I'd recommend likely nested well pairs and additional lines of evidence to further refine what those concerns specifically are at the site. So now we're going to go to a knowledge check. The concept of continually updating the LCSM throughout the remedial process means, A, the LCSM should become increasingly complex throughout the remedial process. B, even if performance monitoring indicates progress towards endpoints, better check between borings to ensure uniform treatment. C, reinvestigate with the latest tools as new characterization technologies evolve. And D, the LCSM is updated to inform decisions throughout the project. Each decision point may require different data. Oh, wow, you guys are, we may need to make this question harder. So we got 99 to 100% on answer D, which is exactly right. The idea of the conceptual model evolving throughout the project is as we move to different decisions, whether it's identifying the concerns, selecting the technology, or implementing it, we're going to be looking towards different lines of evidence or pieces of information each time. In summary, is there sufficient information for a given question to support identification of concerns? That really kind of tells you, do you have the appropriate conceptual model? And if you don't, that's where you go back, take a look at those individual questions, and maybe identify which one of those questions are you most uncertain about and what would help. Is additional site characterization required for evaluating concerns LCSM? Also, you know, initial characterization activities. I do recognize that different sites vary, and you know, some sites you might want to go out and you start collecting data. It's a remote site. You realize remediation is going to be needed, so you already start collecting data for remedial technology selection and design because you have a pretty good idea and you feel pretty confident in that data collection. Other sites may be sufficiently complex where you may want to take your initial round of data back to the office, evaluate it, better understand what specifically the concerns are so that you can be more effective in where you pick your locations to evaluate for remedial technology selection and what those lines of evidence are. I've worked on both types of sites. They both exist, and it's not all or one or the other. So now we're going to have here listen to Eric talk to us about LNAPL concerns, remedial goals, and objectives.
All right. Can you guys hear me?
We can, yes.
Okay, great. So as Andrew identified, just going through the initial LNAPL conceptual site model development, one of the primary reasons that we do that is to identify what are the specific concerns that we have related to the LNAPL body. I just almost wanted to reiterate, though, that chapter where the conceptual site model development is described is chapter 4 in the guidance, and the questions that are related to the initial site model development section are very thorough and definitely worthwhile for people to go through. But now we're going to transition into the decision-making process, which Andrew identified in one of the slides is sort of a parallel process that is developed along with your conceptual site model development and continued refinement. So the purposes of this initial portion of decision making are to, one of the first things we want to do is just become familiar with the key terms, those terms being our specific LNAPL concerns, and then the associated remedial goals and remediation specific objectives. We're going to review three broad categories of technology classes which relate to those objectives, and those are mass recovery, phase change, and mass control. And then lastly, we are going to introduce and describe how to utilize various metrics. The first metric
which is new to the updated guidance, is a threshold metric. And we use that to verify or eliminate the concern to see if we should continue review of that concern as we move forward. And then performance metrics, which people are probably pretty familiar with, but they're technology specific, and they describe and are implemented to describe how is that technology performing and how are we monitoring that technology. So broadly, this is where we are within the management strategy. Having sufficiently developed the initial conceptual site model, we're now really ready to kind of lock in and verify that we have concerns at the site, and from there, establish LNAPL remedial goals associated with those concerns. The two sections listed below as select remedial technology to achieve objectives and install and monitor the performance are described in the third part of the internet-based training series. So concerns, we've seen this slide before, but I'm sorry, I'm trying to play with getting the arrow to work, but it's not working, and that's okay. We've seen this slide before, but as described, the initial conceptual site model really gets developed to identify what concerns do we have. That conceptual site model, once we've identified the concerns, we kind of break apart those concerns into four broad categories. We have risk and safety concerns, migration concerns, mobile occurrence and well concerns, and then, of course, other concerns. Okay, thanks, Juliana. More specifically, getting into those, what those concerns are, let's start with risk and safety. And I suppose it's probably most important to start with the last one identified, which is acute safety concerns. Do we have potential explosive conditions? Do we have fire conditions? From there, we have petroleum vapor intrusion concerns and also the soluble fraction, our groundwater ingestion concerns. Risk and safety concerns largely relate to the composition of the LNAPL. And so they're different for every type of LNAPL that you have, which is why it is important to understand what type of product you're dealing with and what are the constituents within that product type. Migration concerns, we're really concerned with, do we have a future risk? If that NAPL body is moving, does it have the potential to, one, certainly increase in its footprint, which will make it more difficult to manage, but two, does it have the potential to impact a receptor that may be nearby? Our mobile occurrence and well concerns, this really addresses the maximum extent practicable regulatory requirement. And every implementing agency has a slightly different definition of what maximum extent practicable is. Over the years, and the ITRC LNAPL training has certainly assisted in this, but some agencies have certainly adopted looking at the transmissivity, for example, to really evaluate that question, whereas it might be the case, depending on your regulatory framework, that you may have a thickness measurement in a well that needs to be addressed. And then lastly, we have our other concerns. And other, it may relate to sheens that may emanate from the NAPL body. You could have geotechnical concerns, where you might be concerned with how the LNAPL saturation impacts the soil stability. And then there just may be some aesthetic-based concerns related to staining and odor, for example. So this is a view of the decision process, just kind of laid out in the long fashion, but let's just briefly walk through the elements, and then I'll give a quick example of how this relates to more specific concerns. But again, we start with our decision process, having developed an initial conceptual model. We start with identifying our LNAPL concerns. From there, we verify those concerns by utilizing threshold metrics. If the concern cannot be eliminated, meaning that it looks like it needs to be actively managed, we first establish a remedial goal. And this is done in the absence of technology selection. Once we've established our remedial goal, we go through the process of selecting the technology and determining a technology-specific remedial objective. And then these color codings are related to the sections of the guidance that they're in, but establishing metrics and remedial endpoints is really when we have, just prior to implementing our remedy, we go about the process of making sure that we've established those metrics and endpoints. So let's just kind of give a broad example using risk and safety concerns, and let's talk about exposure to vapors. We have that concern based on the site-specific factors of the geology as well as, you know, proximity to buildings, as well as the LMAPL type that we have. Well, the next step is to verify that concern via threshold metrics. And a good threshold metric to utilize may very well be the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Guidance Document, where we identify buildings within the area that we think we might have this concern. But then we utilize a vertical separation distance, which basically through the utilization of empirical evidence as well as understanding of science says that based on this vertical separation distance, you may or may not have a vapor intrusion concern. And of course, that's with consideration given to preferential pathways. But let's just assume that we do have that concern, and so it gets retained. The broad grouping of remedial goal that we're looking at when we're dealing with vapor intrusion is the composition of the LMAPL. So our remedial goal will be a composition-based goal. And from there, these last couple sections are a bit more general. We'll walk through more specific examples later on, but these are example objectives that might be developed and then, of course, the subsequent metrics and endpoints that would also be developed. And so we can see that, based on if you have migration concerns, risk and safety concerns, or mobile occurrence concerns, walking through this process for your various concerns is certainly what we're recommending. And it's worthwhile to note that the majority of LMAPL projects may have more than one concern. So, you know, walking through this, you know, while meticulously, it does lead to better project outcomes, which is what we're trying to achieve. And I should mention that this is figure 5.1, which is in chapter 5 of the web-based LMAPL site management guidance. So let's talk about verifying concerns with threshold metrics a little bit. I had given the example of vapor intrusion for risk and safety. And another very good threshold metric for risk and safety concerns has to do with our dissolve phase impacts. Every implementing agency certainly has a Tier 1 standard, which we're trying to achieve, but a lot of implementing agencies will have a Tier 2 standard. And so that could be a good threshold metric to evaluate, do we actually have a dissolve phase concern, or is it something that the dissolve phase concentrations aren't high enough, so we don't need to actively manage that concern? Same is true with migration. We can run it through the threshold of what lines of evidence do we have to support that it's actually moving. So concerns that are eliminated are not retained for developing goals. Concerns that are not eliminated through the threshold metric process are retained for developing goals. And so as this box identifies, verified concerns need remedial goals. So we have a quick knowledge check that we're going to do, and we'll open up the poll now. Which of these statements is true? An LMAPL concern, A, does not need to be identified before remedial action occurs. B, may sometimes be addressed by testing against the threshold metric. C, is nothing to worry about. Or D, can only be addressed through remedial action. And the polling numbers are coming in quite strong, landing on B, may sometimes be addressed by testing against the threshold metric. And it's, you know, just an important step that we felt necessary to articulate the value of threshold metrics before we go about making costly remedial action determinations that really may not be necessary. So moving along, we're going to talk about the types of goals that are associated with our various concerns. I had demonstrated this in one of the previous diagrams, but when we have risk concerns, we will have a composition-based goal because we're concerned, again, with what are the components of the NAPL, and if we have to manage them, we will have composition-based goals. Migration and mobile occurrence in wells, those, of course, are more saturation-based goals. And this will become apparent later on today, as well as in much more detail in Part 3. But we really categorize the technologies based on their ability to achieve those types of goals. And then lastly, when we get to other, a bit more difficult to put other concerns into the broad categories of composition or saturation, but I guess the point I wanted to make here was it is still, you know, I would say critical to articulate what your goal is and then go about devising a plan of how are we going to achieve that goal. So I had seen some notes in the that were posted, which were what are the differences between goals and objectives. So we're at that point right now. Goals are, here's the arrow. Okay. We're talking about remedial goals. Goals are your broad-based condition that you're trying to achieve, and when you achieved your goal, you have effectively eliminated the concern, so it no longer needs management. Now, remediation objectives are much more specific. They essentially articulate the actions that need to be performed and the desired outcomes that we want to occur based off of a particular chosen technology. So they're much more tactical. They relate to the goal, but really your objective describes what are we going to do to try to advance the project toward achieving that goal. And it's worthwhile noting here that these definitions were previously stated opposite of each other in the 2009 guidance. When we went about developing this updated guidance, which was published in March of this year, it came to our attention that it's more broadly accepted that goals are your overarching thing that you're trying to achieve and that objectives are specific. So while we switched the order, we thought it was necessary to be more in line with how these terms are used more broadly. So what are some examples of remedial goals? Well, when we have composition-based goals, broadly, we might just be looking to reduce the vapor concentration to a certain level or reduce the groundwater concentration to a certain level. Saturation-based goals, when we're talking about mobile occurrence in wells, our goal may simply be to reduce LNAPL saturation. Or when we're talking about migration concerns, we're looking to impede the continued flow of the NAPL. And we develop these goals before choosing a technology. And again, that'll become apparent toward the tail end of this internet-based training. Objectives, on the other hand, they describe, once again, how the goal will be accomplished by a particular technology. And they state the specific actions and desired outcomes that we want to achieve. When we combine the technology with our metrics that we're using, our performance metrics and endpoint metrics, we can develop a SMART objective, which is a specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-based objective. And I think that this is really important to do when, again, we're making costly decisions when we decide how are we going to actively manage these problems. So developing SMART objectives kind of ensures that everyone is on the same page, and it really helps with the overall efficacy of the implementation from both a time and money perspective. So now we'll briefly talk about the broad categories that are encompassed within our remediation objectives. And remediation objectives typically have very action-oriented words like abate, remove, reduce, contain, prevent. So let's talk about mass recovery, for example. We're obviously talking about technologies that can remove the elm apple from the subsurface. When we're talking about phase change, once again, we're concerned with the composition of the elm apple. So what are technologies that are effective in reducing either the dissolved or vapor phase components? And then mass control, once again, it has to do with migration. But broadly understanding these technology groupings, again, is important in articulating what your goal is and then further articulating what your objectives are. Regarding technology groupings, we'll go into this in greater detail in the part three of the training next week. But for each of the 20-some technologies that are reviewed as having demonstrated an ability to help achieve goals, we've put together ternary diagrams. And what I wanted to identify here is that some technologies have more than one effect and may actually help achieve multiple objectives. So take the example of dual phase extraction. Well, with dual phase extraction, we are recovering mass, so it's helping achieve a mass recovery goal or objective, but it also is facilitating a phase change in the form of removing vapors from the subsurface. So then lastly, and this has been discussed a bit, but after we select a remedy, it's important before we implement to really define what are the performance metrics that we're going to use to assure effective implementation. And then what is the endpoint that is a technology-specific endpoint that we say once it reaches this endpoint, we really should consider either A, have we achieved the broad goal, or B, does it make sense to transition to a different technology? So that concludes the initial portion of the decision process, and I'm going to turn it over to Juliana now for our first question and answer session.
Thanks, Eric. For our trainers, please remember in the Q&A to avoid the X button because that deletes the question, makes it a little hard to ask them. And for our audience, you're all safe in the Q&A in the bottom right. If you type in your questions, that's a great way to get questions to us, and we'll ask those questions out loud during this question and answer break. And throughout the second half of the training, you're also welcome to send in questions. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute, that's #6, and ask a question out loud. I'll also remind you at this point, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback, not only to improve today's course, but also, we've mentioned earlier some of the new courses that we're developing, and we're going to use your feedback as we're developing those new courses. So let us know what's working, what's not working. The feedback is also your opportunity to get a certificate of participation for today's class. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. Do you have any questions to start from the phone line audience? It does take just a little bit for our questions to come in. I will remind you that part three of the training is next week on Tuesday. That's May 22nd. And if you did register for this part, you are automatically registered for the next part. We have a question that came in that talks about our part one. How do you rectify the critical thickness as a function of particle size to well boring size?
So the key things in well design, and Duane Hampton, University of Western Michigan State University, I believe, maybe it's just Western Michigan University, did work on this, and the well diameter does not affect your gauged elm apple thickness. When designing a well, though, what does affect it or can affect the communication of oil within the well to the formation is well development and your filter pack and your screen slot size. So if you look at groundwater and well and how to develop design a water well, they talk about scaling your filter pack 4 to 6 times the size of the formation. Elm apple, since those sand packs are hydrophilic and oil-phobic, err towards that 6 factor. And then your screen slot size should be such that 10 or 20% that filter pack can be developed through the screen. And you should use a surge block in developing. This ensures you have the highest quality of wells to do LNAPL bail down testing on, making sure that the LNAPL and the formation's in communication with the well. So the well boring size does not matter greatly.
Would you provide an example of a smart remedial objective?
Sure, I could address that. Well, let's say that you're dealing with NAPL occurrence in a well. And so you obviously have a saturation-based objective that you're trying to achieve. You're going to go about a technology screening process and land on a particular technology. It might be NAPL skimming, depending on how severe that concern is. Maybe it's a bit more of an aggressive system. But let's just say that you are performing NAPL skimming. A good threshold metric to utilize would be, and again, it depends on your regulatory framework, but a good threshold metric to use would be to first evaluate the transmissivity up front. So let's say that your transmissivity identifies that it is recoverable. And again, you've landed on NAPL skimming, so that's a way to make it specific. Now, how are we going to measure it? You can measure it, again, by measurement is really your performance metrics that you're using. So periodically, based off of NAPL gauging that you've observed, you might put in as a performance metric that we're going to measure the transmissivity once NAPL gauging indicates, that it hasn't been recovering as quickly as it had when we started the process. Attainable and relevant, those two components are really tied into the technology selection process that you did. They're sort of built into that screening process. So you know that you're selecting a technology that's able to achieve the goal. And then time-bound, one, it may be associated with the endpoint metric that you put into place. And again, using the example of transmissivity, your endpoint metric, if you agree upon it with all involved stakeholders, so whether you're a consultant or your implementing agency or the property owner, for example, you're going to agree upon an endpoint. And, time-bound, really, I would say it's fair to say that, hey, we think that this objective will be achieved within a certain time frame. But maybe more specifically and more appropriate is this objective will be achieved once this endpoint metric is met.
Another question has come in. Can you please define maximum extent practicable? Is it the extent of any LNAPL or recoverable LNAPL?
So maximum extent practicable, there's some people out there that might be really frustrated with that terminology. And it's interesting because I've been reading more federal regulations, I'm not sure why, but recently, and extent practicable is not just an environmental regulation. It is all over the federal registry. It's just something they put in there when they don't have a good idea of what to do, I think. It's widely in there, and it's every time it's used, it's not well defined, I guess is a better way to say that. And so for our purposes, LNAPL extent practicable is often site specific, state specific, and it's about either the state already has a well defined metric. Some states are still using thickness. And, that can take a lot of effort to reach zero thickness at sites. But other states, are using transmissivity nowadays, so they're focused on the mobile LNAPL fraction and making sure you can get out what is practicable and what recovery systems can easily or practically achieve. I mean, these terms are subjective, right? But you'll see later what that transmissivity value of 0.8 feet squared per day is based on. And other sites, you have to provide multiple lines of evidence to show you know, what is practical to get out of the ground and leave in place. So it's an ongoing discussion, I would say, within our industry.
Is there a specific ITRC guidance around transmissivity and the 0.8 feet squared per day target?
So the 0.1 to 0.8 feet squared per day came out in the 2009 ITRC guidance document. It talked about several sites. There was a small call-out box that mentioned several sites that had been previously closed. Upon going back and re-looking at those sites' data, those sites all had demonstrated that recovery was not going to significantly reduce the remaining impacts, although mobile LMAPL remained in wells, that the plumes were stable, there was no risk to receptors, and then there was sufficient data to calculate transmissivity. It happened, so we calculated it, and the sites that had conducted recovery and saw significant reductions saw their transmissivity values reduced to 0.3 to 0.8 feet squared per day. One site started at 0.1 feet squared per day, had a multi-phase extraction system applied to it, and it remained at 0.1 feet squared per day. Since then, additional efforts have been looked at this, that range of 0.1 to 0.8 feet squared per day. And you'll see some data coming up here on how empirical data identifies that typically when you're in that range, the majority of the oil at your site will be residual. So that's it's really a information to help people understand what does the data mean in the field. And several states, including Virginia and Colorado, have incorporated transmissivity as a specific value as a line of evidence that maximum extent practical has been met.
Thank you. We're about out of time for this question and answer break, so we'll go ahead and continue on. A note for our trainers, if you want to answer questions online, please be sure to avoid the X button that deletes the question. And when you answer the question, please send privately, and that's the icon with the individual person. For our participants, you're welcome to send questions throughout the second half of the training class. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with an answer. And we hope to have more time at the end to ask more questions out loud. We'll now continue on, and I'm going to turn the presentation back over to Andrew Kirkman at BP.
Thank you.
All right.
So we're now going to talk about the Remedy LCSM and why are we focused on it. I talked before about how current practices and resulting CSMs are effective at identifying risks and concerns, and they're also generally sufficient to identify completion of remediation, i.e. there's no more concerns or risk. However, the refinement of CSMs for technology selection, optimization, or confirmation of an existing technology often represents the highest potential for improvement at sites. I work on multiple sites, and historically, the remedies that are currently in place and still operating were selected based on an older understanding of LMAPL occurrence and nature. Sometimes those remediation systems do not have the appropriate performance monitoring metrics to identify, are they still effective? Remediation has often been driven by LMAPL thickness in wells without considering the relationship between LMAPL thickness, recoverability, or although we're taking out 100 gallons from the subsurface, how's that? What's really changing down in the subsurface? How much is down there that's residual versus mobile? So what can we do to inspire the continuation of improvements to CSMs for remedy selection is what we're going to be talking about. So an example scenario would be our concerns are known. We know the remedial technology types. Let's go ahead and move ahead with remediation and give it a shot. There's LMAPL in a well, there's no migration, and let's simply vacuum truck it out. But often, there's insufficient data at the end of the concerns LCSM to choose a remedy that will achieve remedy goals. Transmissivity is an interesting metric. ITRC promotes it as perhaps a threshold metric for understanding maximum extent practicable in sites in states where it matches the regulations. And so at some sites, you may use it as a threshold metric and incorporate it as part of your initial LCSM to identify your concerns. Other regulatory states or environments may simply say, you know, if thickness exists in a well, that's sufficient for maximum extent practicable to remain as a concern. And you may not have LNAPL transitivity in it. Transitivity then, at that point, becomes really a remedial technology selection criteria to help you choose the technology to address that gauged LNAPL thickness. And an example of that is if we have a well with 2 feet of thickness, 2 feet square per day LNAPL transmissivity, and if you look at that volume in the well and account for the LNAPL in the filter pack and the casing, your well typically will have 1.4 gallons stored in it. If we do monthly vacuum truck, someone decides let's choose vacuum truck as our technology, and we induce 2 feet of drawdown by pumping water over a one-hour period, we'll remove the stored volume of 1.4 gallons, plus we'll generate 1.7 gallons of LNAPL from the formation, or about 3 gallons per month and 36 gallons per year. That vacuum truck effort would result in a 0.4% saturation reduction across a 25-foot radius each year. So 4 pores out of 1,000 are being, LNAPL is being removed from 4 pores out of 1,000 across that 25-foot radius, essentially, that fraction. And it would take about 25 years to reach 0.8 feet square per day. However, if we look at our other data, perhaps we have some saturation data or we understand our hydraulic conductivity, we can calibrate an API LDRM model using published soil values and LNAPL parameters. We already know it's a gasoline. Gasoline generally has around 0.8 density, around a 1 viscosity for centipoise. And we can calibrate that model to an LNAPL transmissivity field valve and run active skimming. It would identify that active skimming reaches 0.8 feet squared per day in 0.8 years. Transmissivity is an example of how an improved metric can identify what are we going to accomplish with these two different remedial methods here. If you want more information on quantified estimation tools for remedial technologies, see Table 4-4 in the ITRC LNAPL document. We're going to talk about how to go and develop your LCSM so we can evaluate more technologies than recovery here in these sections. Oh, shoot. So the remedy selection should be informed, remedy selection should be informed by the LCSM, not just by the concern. I'm going to go back to gauge thickness. If we have gauge thickness in a well, it just doesn't automatically mean that recovery is necessarily going to be the best option. We should consider what other options are there to achieve what that remedial goal is. And this section will identify approaches to answer where remediation needs to target, which remedial mechanism may be effective, and improve quantification of these mechanisms prior to implementing a technology. Like the initial LCSM, we developed a list of questions. Where is the source mass? What is the nature of the source? And what is achievable for a given technology to help with remedial technology selection? For the initial LCSM, as we went down in the page on the questions, they became more and more LNAPL specific, and they were general CSM generalized for CSMs at the top. These questions actually build upon each other. Knowing where the source mass first supports understanding what is the nature of the source, and understanding both of those supports what is achievable for a given technology. So where is the source mass? This identifies where to target remediation. It identifies physical factors in the subsurface, like soil permeability, depth of impacts, absolute or even relative to the water table. If you're looking for a list of characterization tools to support this question, you can go to Table 4.2 in the ITRC LNAPL 3 document. It's a nice large table that has your characterization components for whether it's LNAPL type or soil profile. It gives you a list of tools that you can look at as well as methods. and references for those tools. And we're going to go into a brief discussion of some of those tools next. So this is a cross section, which are useful in helping to understand where does our remedial technology focus. In this cross section, we have wells. Here's the well screens here, as well as we have these columns that are blue, meaning that water was simply in that well, or if it's green, that was the gauged oil thickness. Here we have green over blue, we have gauged oil thickness and water in the same well. The red lines represent laser-induced fluorescence, pushing a tool that shoots a laser in the formation. The LNAPL impacts fluoresce or ultraviolet light, and that response is measured and plotted on these cross-sections. The olive up here is fill material, coarse gravel, sand. The darker brown here represents fine-grained clay and silt materials. And the sand is down at the bottom here in tan. The LIF data here indicates that the bulk of our LNAPL is in the sandy aquifer. And we're going to zoom in on this location now. And we can see here, this is our sandy aquifer, and this is our overlying clay. The bulk of the LNAPL is here in the aquifer, although the gauged LNAPL thickness occurs over the clay as well. This is because this LNAPL is confined. This is a confined aquifer. LNAPL had enough pressure during the release to penetrate the water table and spread out in the sandy layers here and become confined LNAPL. If we were going to be wanting to recover LNAPL here, we probably wouldn't want to be targeting the clay interval. It's low permeability. It doesn't have a large LIF response. We need to be targeting the lower sand. Similarly, if we wanted to improve dissolve phase, if dissolve phase was a concern and we wanted to reduce dissolve phase flux and concentrations, again, we would be wanting to target the sand. Not every site, I realize, can go out and perform LIF. I have sites where conditions just aren't feasible due to fill materials or depths or other considerations performing high resolution characterization. Alternate ways to identify where the LNAPL is consists of diagnostic gauge plots. These were discussed briefly in the first webinar last week. Here we have your fluid interface elevation on the y-axis, and here we have gauged LNAPL thickness. And what we can do is for a given gauging date, we can plot the oil-water interface and the air-oil interface elevations on the y-axis versus the gauged LNAPL thickness. This is most useful for equilibrium data. If we're out there bailing wells off daily or weekly, the gauging data we collect may not be in equilibrium and we get a lot more scatter like these data points here in red. We want our well to be in equilibrium to use this tool. And what this shows us is that our oil-water interface is relatively constant over all gauge thicknesses, and our air-oil interface increases with gauge thickness. This is indicative of confined LNAPL. It's the exact opposite behavior as unconfined, where as the water table drops and your air-oil and potentiometric surface drop, your thicknesses increase. When we plot the geology information over this graph, we can see that our oil-water interface to the confining contact identifies the zone that LNAPL likely exists in, and that these air-oil interface elevations are likely represent confining pressure rather than a mobile LNAPL interval in the formation. This is really, again, the zone that we're likely going to target. And perhaps this is a sufficient argument to justify that now a LIF study is actually needed, or a higher resolution tool. This is another cross section to support where is the LNAPL. And here we have laser-induced fluorescence again with some residual responses in the beta zone. Here is our wells and our water tables here. This well has a small amount of LNAPL in it, and this one actually has 4 feet. We are going to zoom in on this LNAPL occurrence here. So what we did here is we have another diagnostic gauge plot. Our corrected groundwater elevation is plotted on the y-axis. Our gauged LNAPL thickness is on the x-axis. And for this occurrence, as the water table drops, our gauged LNAPL thickness increases. when we look at the core data, so I put a rectangle here saying this is the interval representing this core. And when we look at the core data, we have our visible showing that we have sandy layers with fine-grained silt. And the sandy layers in the UV, the UV photograph are the ones that are fluorescing. Those are the ones that are containing the L-NAPL. And when we consider that this L-NAPL is here in between two silty lenses, it's going to have a hard time moving up and down with the water table. Essentially, this is perched L-NAPL. The L-NAPL is perched near or above the water table, and as the water table drops, the L-NAPL flows into the well kind of like a waterfall at lower elevation for lower water table elevations and creates an iceberg effect, resulting in large gauged L-NAPL thicknesses. So as I said, unconfined L-NAPL exhibits a similar behavior. As the water table drops, so the gauged L-NAPL thickness increases. The difference between perched and gauged or an unconfined L-NAPL is that for a given water table elevation drop, unconfined, the thickness would increase by about a foot or less of L-NAPL thickness. You're exposing that much vadozone, and it's going to increase by a foot or less in terms of your L-NAPL thickness. We dropped here a foot, and our thickness increased by 4 feet, a factor of four. Perched conditions, you'll see that the thickness increases by much larger factors for a given water table drop than unconfined. So, you know, again, these are different tools. You have core photography to help confirm, you have laser-induced fluorescence, and you have diagnostic gauge plots to help get you started in characterizing where is the L-NAPL. You can see I'm a real diagnostic gauge plots because we're going to be looking at a third one here, and this is for a bedrock application. So here we have our oil-water interface, which is relatively constant over the gauged L-NAPL thickness. And here we have the green triangles represent the potentiometric surface, and the red diamonds represent the air-oil interface. As the water table and air-oil interface rise, we get larger thicknesses, indicating that this L-NAPL is confined. When we look at a conductivity profile, which can help identify fractures, we see that this oil-water interface lines up with a dip in the conductivity profile, indicating a fracture right there. In bedrock, this is one of the biggest challenges. Which fractures do we need to target for our remediation technology? And this is what's going to help identify where to target that remediation technology. So for where is the source, characterization data. Soil characterization is important. You know, looking at soil boring logs, cone penetrometer tool, hydraulic profiling tool, core photographs, these help to identify where injection, gradient-driven technologies, will other technologies need to target. The fluid elevation versus soil data. That helps identify the hydrogeologic condition of the mobile L-NAPL. It doesn't tell you much maybe about the residual necessarily, but all of these tools are worthwhile for understanding that mobile L-NAPL interval and its behavior and how to treat it. For residual oil as well as mobile, we can be looking at headspace data, PIDs for gasoline range. You know, note that gasoline is a volatile L-NAPL, whereas other L-NAPLs such as lube oil may be less effectively identified via PIDs. Shape tests. These are something that I've utilized more and more because somebody can be looking at the soil and it might be black, and they may log black stained soil, which may or may not be hydrocarbon impacts. Hydrocarbon creates reducing conditions, which can create reduced minerals such as iron sulfides. Iron sulfides are known to stain the soil black, and that's not because it's L-NAPL there, it's because of the mineral itself. So shake tests, we can shake the black soil, and if a sheen occurs or a layer of L-NAPL appears, we can document that, and it's an objective test that is, you know, can be trusted at a larger scale. TPH analysis, high-resolution tools, as well as L-NAPL transitivity maps, can help identify where is the source, as well as geophysical data. You know, there is also, in addition to the NSED and L-NAPL transitivity appendices, there's a bedrock appendix in the LNAPL 3 document, as well as the ITRC fractured rock guide. And so now we're going to hand it over to Jonathan Smith to talk about the nature of the source. So we discussed that whereas the source was a relatively easy discussion, whereas the next discussion is going to get a little more intense.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, so as Andrew said, he just walked us through the importance of understanding where our source mass is, and now we're going to jump into talking about why and how to understand the nature of the source material. So we're doing this so that we can assess the efficacy of different remedial mechanisms. For example, we need to know if our LNAPL is volatile, if it's going to be biodegradable, how much of the LNAPL is mobile versus residual. So the types of data and information that we use to understand the nature of the source, just like all the other data types that we're looking at today, they can be more qualitative, sort of more of a tier one characterization data, or they can be more quantitative, higher resolution data that we would use for like a tier two or a tier three evaluation, going back to one of the slides that Andrew talked about earlier. For example, at some of our sites, we might have knowledge of historical site use and release history, and that might provide us some insight into the likely composition of the LNAPL, and that might be good enough, while at other sites we may need more quantitative laboratory analysis to better understand, how volatile is the LNAPL or how biodegradable is it going to be. There's a good resource, Table 4.2 in the guidance document. It includes a pretty good list of tools and methods that we can use to assess chemical and physical properties, LNAPL recoverability, and natural degradation processes. So when we're building our remedy select LCSM, we ask the question, what's the nature of the source? We're really trying to get a better understanding of what types of remedial mechanisms are going to be effective for addressing the LNAPL impacts that we have. We want to develop tools and metrics that we can use to evaluate those different mechanisms. And one of those metrics that we'll be talking about today, and we've already talked about it up to this point, is LNAPL transmissivity. So Juliana, if you could open the poll, we wanted to gauge the level of experience and familiarity of the class with LNAPL transmissivity here. So, Andrew's already talked a little bit about LNAPL transmissivity and how we can use it to assess hydraulic recoverability. And we'll be talking about it more as we go through the training. So what if we want to look at biodegradability or vapor phase mass transfer remedies? We'll also have information on, we can learn a lot looking at LNAPL composition, soil gas composition data. These can tell us something about biodegradability and volatility. You might even be able to just look at soil gas and headspace PID readings from soil borings to get an idea of relative volatility. So let's see here. Looks do we still have some people coming in on the poll? Looks like there's a pretty good mix of experience and familiarity. Most people, it looks like, have some, at least an understanding, if not a lot of experience using transmissivity. So this is really helpful to know, and we'll try and incorporate this for some of the discussion on LNAPL transmissivity later in the training. So Juliana, if you can close the poll and go ahead and move on here. Okay, so again, for the remedy select LCSM, we want to characterize our site with metrics related to remedial mechanisms in mind. So here we're showing some of the characterization data over on the right on this slide that we can use to evaluate different remedial technologies and different technologies that utilize different mechanisms. So if we're contemplating hydraulic recovery technologies, we might look to LNAPL transmissivity or data that helps us define the fraction of LNAPL that's mobile versus residual. We might look at LMAPL composition and vapor pressure if we're trying to evaluate the potential effectiveness of technologies that rely on, a vapor phase mass transfer, like aquifer sparging or soil vapor extraction. And we can complete an in-situ respiration test or something of that nature to evaluate the effectiveness of technologies like bioventing or biosparging that may be able to significantly enhance the biodegradation rates at our site. So part three of the training series will get into more detail on all those remedial technologies and explain how different remedial mechanisms associated with different technologies often overlap. Eric talked about that a little bit earlier even today. And again, it's worth noting that the focus of our characterization efforts when we're developing this remedy select conceptual site model, it's different from the concerns LCSM, as Andrew was talking about. There's a really good chance that we wouldn't even need to be characterizing these aspects of our site unless we had established that remediation was necessary. So sort of highlighting something we discussed earlier. Why do we need to understand our source zone in three dimensions? And at this point, I'd like to ask Juliana to open another poll question for us, and we can sort of walk through this exercise together. So here we've got an example site. We've got a dissolve phase concern. For example, maybe it's benzene that's sourced in an LMAPL body. As you can see in the figure off to the right here, we've got LMAPL transmissivity data for the site, and it indicates that LMAPL is recoverable in some areas of the site. We also have data that shows us that the LMAPL is stable and not migrating. So given this information, are we ready to proceed with a hydraulic recovery remedy? And we can think about, what is hydraulic recovery going to do to address that dissolve phase concern? And I'll maybe wait for a minute just to make sure everybody's chimed in. Yeah, it looks like we've got sort of a division between yes and insufficient information. So I'm gonna, let's just go ahead and move to the next slide so we can close out the poll and move to the next slide. And now we're gonna look at this site in a little bit higher resolution in three dimensions, get a more complete picture of the LMAPL distribution. And we can see that the interval of mobile MAPL at this site is about 1 to 2 feet, so right in here. And we've got 30 and 60 feet of residual LMAPL above and below the mobile zone. So we can see that the vast majority of the LMAPL mass at this site is residual. And any effort focused on hydraulic recovery within that mobile interval, it's probably not likely to have any effect on the groundwater quality concerns at the site. So, this is an example of a pretty large refinery site where there's been some historical water table depression. But these same principles would apply for smaller sites. So we can consider a smaller release into similar soil conditions where the relative difference between the mobile interval and the smear zone, maybe it's not as dramatic, but in either case, you need a more complete understanding of that vertical distribution of mobile and residual LMAPL when you're looking to develop an effective remedial strategy. So on here. All right, so there's a number of approaches for estimating mobile and residual LMAPL fractions. Here we're going to talk about what LMAPL transmissivity tells us about mobile and residual LMAPL. So here we're kind of showing some of the background information that was used to establish the 0.1 to 0.8 feet squared per day range of LMAPL transmissivity. So that's the range that was put forth in the 2009 ITRC LMAPL guidance document. So to put it in context, we can start by just noting that L-methyl at residual saturation has zero L-methyl transmissivity, right? And we can think of maybe a small threshold transmissivity value that would represent a saturation slightly above residual, where a really small fraction of the L-methyl is recoverable. And that's really what the range presented in the 2009 guidance represents. So in most settings, if you've got an L-methyl transmissivity that's within that range, that can be viewed as a pretty strong qualitative indication that the majority of your L-methyl is present as a discontinuous residual phase. So we've got some references for additional information on L-methyl transmissivity at the bottom of the slide here, including a reference to Appendix C in the updated guidance, the ITRC guidance. And there'll also be some additional discussion on L-methyl transmissivity later in the training today. So we spent some more time talking about hydraulic recoverability. So what about characterizing, you know, L-methyl composition, and what about volatility? So we point you to Table 3.2 in the guidance document. It provides some good indicators of volatility with gasoline in mind. We would also be able to infer something about composition based on site knowledge. For example, if we have good documentation indicating that only gasoline has ever been handled at a site, we can be fairly confident that the L-methyl we have is a gasoline. We can also look at composition through laboratory analysis, for example, gas chromatography with a flame ionization detector. So GCFID data can be really useful for identifying L-methyl type and estimating the degree of degradation. And this bar chart that we're showing on the bottom of the slide, it's sort of analogous to what we get with a GCFID data to help us to determine L-methyl type. And it's something we'll sort of carry through on the next few slides here. So on this slide, we've got a chromatogram for a gasoline fraction of an L-methyl. And when looking at these chromatograms, the height of the peaks here, so these peaks, the height on the y-axis, it gives us a relative indication of the mole fraction for individual hydrocarbon constituents in the L-methyl. And along the x-axis here, we're showing smaller, lighter weight hydrocarbons on the left, and as we move to the right, the hydrocarbon compounds increase in size and molecular weight and boiling point. So we've overlaid on this chart some of the individual constituent IDs, and we can see chromatograms like this that contain a lot of detail. Really for the purposes of what we're talking about today, we're really interested in identifying the different ranges. So we've highlighted in most of the stuff we're talking about where the gasoline, where the diesel range is, where the, you know, heavier weight ranges are. So if we're looking at a chromatogram with a higher proportion of peaks over on the left side in the gasoline range, we can infer that a volatilization mechanism could be pretty effective for us. Of course, we also need to consider what we just learned from Andrew in where is the source. We need to verify that we can also, we've got geology conditions that are appropriate for a remedy that relies on that mechanism. So we've got another example chromatogram. This time we're looking at a fresh diesel, and we can see we don't really have a whole lot of signal over in the blue, the gasoline range here. And this is why we really don't see vapor concerns or dissolved BTEX concerns very often associated with diesel releases. So the lack of the peaks in the gasoline range, it tells us that remedies that are reliant on a vapor phase mass transfer mechanism are probably not going to be that effective. However, the really prominent peaks that we do see here on the diesel chromatogram, these are dominated by normal alkanes. And alkanes are really ideal for biodegradation. which we'll talk about a little bit more here. So we can just briefly, I want to talk about natural source zone depletion and the importance of it for our remedy select LCSM. If you were present for part one of the training, there was some excellent material on NSCD, and there'll be a lot more really good discussion on natural source zone depletion in part three of the training next week. So would encourage everybody to attend that as well. Today, we're really focused on evaluating biodegradation as a remedial mechanism, and we want to look at NSCD as a means of providing a useful baseline for assessing biodegradation potential. So maybe similar to how we might use LMAPL transmissivity to think about recovery potential, or look at volatility to think about our vapor phase removal potential. We've discussed the importance of understanding mobile and residual LMAPL fractions. We've talked a little bit about composition with respect to volatility. Now we're jumping in and talking about the biodegradation aspects of composition and how that relates to remediation. So in part one of the training, you saw that biodegradation, it occurs across the full spectrum of hydrocarbons. It's not really limited to lighter end, more soluble compounds. However, biodegradation is dependent on molecular structure. So saturated hydrocarbons tend to be more biodegradable. More highly branched hydrocarbons are more difficult for microbes to utilize. So we can maybe relate this to how we utilize glucose in our own metabolism. Glucose is the most basic substrate for us. And for many microbes, alkanes are sort of analogous to glucose maybe. So when we have more complicated structures with bonds that are more difficult to break, lower ratios of hydrogen to carbon, and there's a lower energy yield, the microbes can't degrade those compounds as efficiently. Okay, so take a look at we've been focused on these different mechanisms. We're going to kind of look at them all together on this slide. Evaluate the relative efficacy of three different remedial mechanisms, just as a function of composition. So right now we're showing compounds just like we've been with the chromatograms. We've got increasing molecular weight from left to right. We've got here relative vapor pressure in this purple plum color. And not surprisingly, we can see that the lighter compounds in the gasoline range, they have a higher vapor pressure. They're much more suitable for a vapor phase mass transfer remedy. Next, we've got biodegradation rate constants. And these are shown in green. And you can see that biodegradation, compared to volatility, exhibits relatively little variability over the full range of the hydrocarbons that we're looking at here. And finally, we've got solubility, a relative solubility shown in the blue here. So a couple notes on this chart. All of the values that we're looking at were normalized to naphthalene. So that sort of gives us a it's the heavy end of the gasoline range. If you've worked on gasoline sites, hopefully that's maybe a nice benchmark to think about. The parameters, it's we should note the parameters that we're showing, they're not really in the same units, so we can't really compare the absolute values that we're looking at. But what we can compare is the variability in those values as a function of hydrocarbon constituents. So while vapor pressure is decreasing over about 5 orders of magnitude in the gasoline range, and much more than that for the heavier constituents, biodegradation is much less variable, and it occurs at similar rates throughout most of the spectrum here. worth noting that the dissolution mechanism isn't really all that effective. And also interestingly, the biodegradability is not really strongly correlated to solubility. And maybe that's, you know, I think as you learned in part one of the training, this really highlights, you know, dissolution not really a necessary precursor for biodegradation. So we're going to sort of review some of the stuff we've talked about in the nature of the source here, and what types of data can inform our evaluation for different remedial mechanisms. So we know that we need to understand permeability distribution. We need to understand the extent of impacts for all of the different mechanisms. For looking at recovery, we've talked a lot about how we can use L-MAPL transmissivity. We can use natural source wind depletion or respiration test data that could be really useful for evaluating bioremediation approaches. And composition data can help inform bioremediation or vapor phase mass transfer remedies. Here we're looking at some additional examples of characterization data that can be used to evaluate remedies that rely on reagent or carbon injection, use of surfactants and thermal remediation technologies. So I'm going to try and wrap up the nature of the source here. We've talked about different tools that we have that we can use to evaluate the efficacy of different remedial mechanisms. We really don't need to just assume that hydraulic recovery is the default answer when we have some recoverable L-MAPL at our sites. We can compare the expected performance for other mechanisms to determine which mechanism or combination of mechanisms is likely to be the most effective for us. And oftentimes comparing performance between different mechanisms, it can be a challenge just because the units that we use are different. So get to familiarize yourself with different unit conversions and things to make for comparable metrics. But the point is that we can do that, and we should do that. So I think I'm going to hand it back over to Andrew to talk more about the third part of the remedy selection LCSM, what's achievable for a given technology.
I got stuck answering a question. So we can come back to that question, though, for that person. We're going to talk about what is achievable for a given technology. And this is going to build upon the past two questions. Because what's achievable for a given technology is site-specific. It matters what your soil type is, your L-MAPL type, above ground considerations, as well as the characteristics of that technology itself. And so we're going to look at site-specific things that affect a remedial effectiveness, include cost, waste, impact to current land usage, and safety. You can use the ITRC appendix tables and external technology-specific references to support this evaluation. And I recognize there's a lot of guidance out there on these feasibility criteria. What we're going to try and do is give you some L-MAPL-specific practical quantified limits, I guess, to go off of or to help start off with. So we're trying to give it a little more focus rather than just saying evaluate this. We're going to try and give you some more ranges like that ITRC L-MAPL transmissivity range to think about. So we're first going to talk about that L-MAPL transmissivity. And L-MAPL transmissivity, really, it's a leading and lagging metric, but I like to think of it in terms of the context of today's talks as you can use it as a threshold metric for evaluating maximum extent practical. Not every site is going to use it for that. Other sites may have other metrics they're going to be using for maximum extent practicable. But then it should consistently be used to estimate what the recoverability, what is the recovery performance expected? What is that expected recovery performance? It's really going to be hard to find an alternative metric that is as good as LNAPL transmissivity to quantify recovery performance. I mean, think about it. Groundwater transmissivity is that metric for groundwater production. And that's why LNAPL transmissivity is going to be consistently used for that second purpose. And the third is, and we're going to talk about here, is LNAPL transmissivity can give you it's like an empirical understanding that is the majority of your site likely residual. So we're going to look at four sites. One site, one's a 400 foot per day sand and gravel aquifer. Site two is a 30 foot per day sand overlain by fine grain silts and clays. Site three is a 0.3 foot per day sandy silt, and I apologize, site four is actually 3 feet per day silty sand, not 0.03. It's a 3 foot per day silty sand. And so we're going to look at the fraction of LNAPL recovered above the 0.3 to 0.8 feet squared per day range, along with what is the remaining residual and mobile fractions left behind. And so on this graph here, we're going to be looking at a graph where the y-axis is fraction of initial LNAPL volume. So we have an initial LNAPL volume or unit volume in place, and this is the fraction of that volume. And for site one and two, that initial volume represents the mobile interval, you know, what's between the air, oil, and oil water interface. That was where the majority of the LNAPL existed. We didn't have a lot of data to quantify the smear zones at those two sites. And so, you know, it's basically you're ignoring that residual zone, whereas sites three and four, we do include the mobile interval plus the residual values because we had TPH data to quantify that residual source area. Let's see here. So now we're going to take a look at the columns and further understand what this graph is presenting. So down here we have well number seven. Sometimes we might have multiple wells combined because our totalizers represented multiple wells. We have a starting oil transmissivity. So this is 14 feet squared per day. Some of our transmissivities started well below 0.1 feet squared per day. Then this dark blue column here represents fraction of LNAPL recovered within above the proposed endpoint range. So we recovered 75% above 0.3 to 0.8 feet squared per day. Upon reaching value, that's the top of this bar. The next, the light blue area represents the fraction of LNAPL that was recovered, but less than 0.8 feet squared per day. And then the gray represents the remaining mobile fraction left behind, and this granitic-looking pattern, or pepper, represents the residual LNAPL. Residual LNAPL masses were estimated based on data, LNAPL F factors for saturation, which you can read about in the guidance document, and other TPH soil data here, as well as LNAPL modeling. So when we take a look at all of the wells, site one, by the time we got to the ITRC endpoint range, the majority of the mass was residual, and the mobile fraction remaining was small relative to residual. Site two was the 30 foot per day sand that was confined. You see here that the time in recovery to reach that 0.3 to 0.8 feet squared per day endpoint range was much longer. This is because site one used kind of a grid-like network of closely spaced recovery wells with water extraction, and although site two utilized water extraction, it was more like a trench. They basically put a trench of wells down at the down gradient boundary and waited for the LNAPL to get to those wells over time rather than using a grid approach. So it was less aggressive and took longer amount of time. But at the end of it, the majority of the mass was residual and the mobile LNAPL was relatively small in comparison. So site three was that 0.3 foot per day silt material, and although they recovered for 10 years, on it. They recovered very little of the fraction. That's because the majority of the L-NAPL was residual at the start. We had very low transmissivity values indicating most of the oil's residual there. We're not going to be producing large volumes. For was similar. They got more out at starting around 0.35 feet squared per day, but the majority, the source was really dominated by residual L-NAPL. So that's what this is telling you. If you have low L-NAPL transmissivity values, then L-NAPL recovery is going to be targeting a minor fraction of the remaining source area. And it would be good to understand some other mechanisms as well. So John talked about natural source zone depletion, and one of the things that natural source zone depletion has gotten me thinking about over the last several years is how much biodegradation can actually do. And I started looking, and I found out in the 90s there was a lot of documents put out by the US EPA and Air Force on bioventing, where you're adding oxygen to the vadose zone to enhance biodegradation of soil impacts. And API recently has put together a database of L-NAPL transmissivity values, and we can convert those L-NAPL transmissivity values into recovery rates. We assume 16 skimmers per acre, which is about a 22-foot radius of capture, or place a recovery well with 1.6 feet of water drawdown every 240 feet. And you can get recovery rates similar to what these are down here for the transmissivity values. So, you know, these are the relative frequencies at sites that we would expect these recovery rates. And L-NAPL transmissivity, as soon as you start recovering, you're going to start to see decreases in transmissivity typically. And so this is going to be a first order decline type process. As you start here, you're going to see these rates drop off. And as John talked about, for bioventing, these white columns here represent the rates in the US EPA database. They are oxygen utilization values that we converted into degradation rate of gallons per acre per year per foot of soil treated. And it's interesting to note that the average removal rates are similar to what we see for transmissivity values. The potential at most sites we're looking at is similar, except this is per foot of soil treated, right? So if you have 5 feet of soil treated, this value is going to go up much higher. Or the way I look at it is you have L-NAPL distributed in an unconfined setting about the water table. If that water table fluctuates 5 feet a year, you can be treating that 5 foot of smear zone for half the year, and then the water table will rise up and re-smear L-NAPL, regenerating your bioreactor, your in-situ bioreactor. It's important to note that microbes are not limited by the concentration of L-NAPL. It's not too toxic for them. I still hear a lot of people talking about this, but really microbes have adapted to eat oil. In the Gulf of Mexico, they sit around hydrothermal vents where there's natural oil seeps supporting communities based on sulfur reduction and petroleum degradation. They have mechanisms to directly attach onto L-NAPL globules to extract out low solubility alkane molecules. Those alkanes, they love them, but they're like sugar to them. They are not soluble, but they have other mechanisms to get them out. Microbes are primarily limited by nutrients, water content, composition of the oil. So if it's a diesel fuel, that's right for biodegradation. If it's a heavy tar material, say for tar sands that has a lot of asphaltenes in it, biodegradation is going to be lower rates because those are more complex molecules. So soil vapor extraction. Vapor extraction is often focused towards gasoline, and this is an example of some chromatograms. John talked about the chromatograms. We have the lighter ends over here, such as butane, benzene perhaps is somewhere over here, and over here we have naphthalene. And so as we apply, this is an evaporation experiment that was conducted, and as we allow the L-NAPL to evaporate 25%, 50%, we can see that the lighter ends are volatilizing, but things like toluene and naphthalene and these heavier range, which are trimethylbenzenes, are hanging around. And that's because While gasoline starts at a vapor pressure of 9 psi, the components from toluene down to here are often 0.4 to 0.002 psi. Your vapor pressure, or your ability to volatilize, is decreasing by a factor of 20 to several hundred. And the reason why most soil vapor extraction sites do not see toluene left over is because soil vapor extraction, when it applies that suction, is drawing ambient atmospheric air into the subsurface, which helps supports biodegradation. And biodegradation of these components is still high. And toluene is one of the most biodegradable components in gasoline. So it's worthwhile to measure CO2 concentrations to compare vapor removal to biodegradation rates. And it's worthwhile to look at your composition to indicate, okay, you know, where am I relative to fresh gasoline, to weathered gasoline, and to diesel, and do I really want to be thinking about the vapor removal mechanism based on my soil type, or trying to enhance that biodegradation more? What am I going to focus on? I'm going to talk about a case study here, a site with multi-phase extraction within terraced and channelized deposits. It was used to address historical gasoline release, and water table fluctuations are significant and affect all the remedial mechanisms. Essentially here, we have a lot of bedrock here, and this olive is fine-grained clays and silts. Yellow is coarser sands and gravels, and the green is fine sands. As we have a graph here of cumulative LNAPL mass recovered for each mechanism. So the green line is the biodegradation based on measuring CO2 from the vapor stream. We have the vapor mass in pounds, as well as the liquid oil recovered, how much oil flowed into that multi-phase extraction system. And initially, the system, it was targeting the recoverable LNAPL. And our LNAPL recovery rates, the black is the highest initially, but then it quickly tailed off, and vapor and bio surpassed it. Ultimately, for a gasoline range material, bio has removed 1.1 million pounds of gasoline. Vapor has removed about just under 800,000, and LNAPL under 400,000. And so looking at this, even for gasoline, you know, there's definitely transition points here for with all three of these mechanisms, and understanding your transmissivity, how weathered is that gasoline currently, and how biodegradable is that oil will help choose between these remedial mechanisms. And as I said, drought conditions affected this site significantly. Here, during this quarter of operation, there was a drought condition, extending more veto zone, more LNAPL became mobile, because as the water table drops, less oil is submerged, and residual saturations in the veto zone are lower than they are when saturated conditions. So our LNAPL recovery increased, but so did our vapor removal and our biodegradation removal, because we were able to get more oxygen to a new impacted zone, newly exposed impacted zone, as well as remove the vapors from it. And so the one thing about this site is after this 24 quarters of operation, benzene concentrations in groundwater still remain above the remedial goal. So the question is what mechanism is going to, what mechanism do you think was going to be most effective in continuing to support benzene reduction in groundwater? What should we be targeting for on the source? What mechanism should we be focused towards? Yeah, most people are saying bioremediation, and that's exactly what where the site is headed, is considering bioremediation of that submerged LNAPL, essentially, that's in contact with groundwater. Because the drought conditions gave us a good insight that there's still additional mass probably below the water table. So site limits of technology combine inherent technical limits with site considerations. You can utilize existing remedial performance data when selecting alternate remedies. Decline curve analysis, this is where you plot a recovery rate or a mass removal rate on the y-axis versus cumulative volume removed on the x. So while when things are first order and they're asymptoting with time, often they give you a linear relationship when you plot the recovery rate or mass removal rate versus volume removed. And you can better understand what is my ultimate removal volume going to be, where how close am I to that, and how effective is the system going to be continually. We can be looking at sustainability analysis and waste generation. One of the things I mean here is if I'm running a thermal oxidizer to treat 100 ppm of vapor in the waste stream, those are a lot of times those are sites where if I simply biovent, I inject the air, I will get a similar overall rate of biodegradation and the vapor will actually be degraded in situ. I likely have a sufficient vato zone to degrade those vapors, and that's site specific. If my water table is 5 feet below the ground surface and I have an active retail station there or nearby commercial residential buildings, I probably would not do that. But if I have a 30-foot vato zone, 10 feet of clean soil near the top, that would be an example of that. The waste stream, you know, for one technology, both technologies might be as effective, whereas one waste stream might be a represent a higher cost. And that's what we're kind of discussing there. And so, you know, when we're looking at site-specific things, you know, above ground infrastructure or other physical obstacles may represent those technology limits. And it's worthwhile to discuss those and how those affected your remedial selection process. You know, and I looking at a tiered approach for remedy evaluation, selection evaluation, some sites you may be able to go out and take a look and realize it's a gasoline site. I understand my subsurface oil profile, and I know my oil transmissivity, or have a good idea that most of my mass is submerged. I can go ahead and select a technology. Other sites might benefit from analytical or other modeling tools. I talked about this briefly before, but this is in Table 4-4 of the guidance, provides some existing references. It's amazing how much information the Army Corps of Engineers has put out on soil vapor extraction, bioventing technologies over the years that I don't consistently see in reports. And these documents can also identify, you know, what you might want to characterize your site for in order to use those tools. One of the things I see for remedy selection is unit conversion challenges. We often report LMAPL recovery rate in gallons per day, vapor in pounds per hour. You know, in situ chemical oxidation might be a change in dissolved phase or source mass or dollars per pound. And NSCD is using gallons per acre per year. You know, perhaps not for ISCO, but a lot of these, I like now putting all of my units into gallons per acre per year for a more consistent evaluation of technology performance. Looking at those costs and those other feasibility, standard feasibility metrics will be useful, as well as sustainable metrics or risk to workers, risk reduction to the community. Technically achievable, you know, for a given remedial mechanism, there are typically multiple lines of evidence to help understand or quantify performance expectations for that mechanism, and those can be used to direct remedy selection. So we've provided a list here for recovery, volatilization, biodegradation, and injection. We're going to go to a knowledge check now. So we have a sheen on a creek. LMAPL is in a well nearby. LMAPL transmissivity is less than 0.05 feet squared per day. Should recovery be considered? Is it likely to be the final remedy? What else could be done to improve remedy selection? So our answers are coming in. So a lot of people are selecting, should recovery be considered? No. You know what? I hate to say it, but a lot of sites do recovery, I guess. Well, I don't hate. They do. It's an interim measure, though, right? It's not a final remedy. If we need to get that sheen off the creek today, we may want to induce hydraulic control and make it a losing stream if possible. Some sites may not be able to treat that water. Other sites, we may want to avoid that Clean Water Act violation. But it's definitely not going to be the final remedy. There's residual oil there. Sheens can be generated from both residual and mobile El Napo. There's different mechanisms that are occurring. So what can we do to improve the final remedy? Improve vertical and horizontal resolution of impacts. I agree with that one. Understanding exactly what that pathway is, understanding the biodegradation rate, understanding what is the typical gradient, are the microbes active, what's the rate that biodegradation is occurring at, and how could we enhance it. All of those are useful. And, you know, maybe soil vapor extraction would be effective here. If you have a gasoline and that's what's causing the sheen, soil vapor extraction might be effective in not only enhancing biodegradation but volatilizing that El Napo before it has a chance to migrate. You're creating a loss mechanism for that as it's moving down gradient and potentially weathering it before it reaches the surface water body. So with that, I think we can move back to Eric Bessert, who will finish up on on our training today.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. I think that both Andrew and John did a good job of demonstrating why revisiting the conceptual site model during the remedy selection process is useful. A lot of in-depth detail provided. So we have seen this slide before. We're walking back into the decision process. We've selected a remedy, and now we're just going to talk about the metrics and endpoints. Performance metrics are technology specific. They verify the remedies being implemented effectively. They allow for those mid-course corrections. Essentially, we've developed a hypothesis of sorts about what the problem is and about what we're going to do to address that problem. But as we know, when we put everything to full-time field scale or, you know, full implementation field scale, there might be some observations that we have where we should be continuously checking that hypothesis we put together. And then lastly, what a performance metric does is it tracks the progress towards the endpoint that we've established. So let's just go over a quick example, bioventing. You're trying to reduce mass and or, you know, address, well, really just reduce mass in the vadose soils. So an example for a performance metric for bioventing, where we're essentially trying to facilitate aerobic biodegradation of the LNAPL, is to make sure that we're maintaining a specified minimum oxygen content, probably something around the order of, you know, 5 part per million by volume oxygen content within those soils. And that's something that we want to track and can help let us know if we are if things are progressing the way that we're looking for. Regarding endpoints, they're also technology specific. One thing that we didn't really address today that I want to briefly touch on here is the endpoint. It may very well be that the concern is no longer present, which means that we've achieved our goal. But as we've identified, endpoints are technology and objective specific. And within Section 5 of the guidance, we have a section on technology transitions. It's become much more commonly accepted today that phased approaches to managing problems is something that we should really plan for, as opposed to have it sort of be, well, we did this, we didn't get to the end, so now we're going to try this, we didn't get to the end. So this sort of practical limit of the technology is, you know, what I just consider honest accounting of what a technology can readily achieve. And as Andrew just got done going through with what are the technical practicabilities of certain methods, that's something that an endpoint can be. So the endpoint could either be that we've managed the concern and it no longer exists, or it might mean that it's time to transition the technology. And this has to do with the overall project efficacy once again. When we define those endpoints up front, we can more readily transition, which means that we're not wasting time. And as a result of wasting time, we're not wasting money on a project that could be better utilized elsewhere. So quick poll question here, which statement is true? Remedial performance metrics and endpoints are A, optional, B, the same for every technology, or C, technology and site specific. And I don't think that one tricked many people. As we've identified, you know, the metrics and endpoints really need to be technology and site specific. So we'll close out that poll. Wanted to go through, we had talked about in the first question and answer, what are examples of SMART objectives? And so this kind of puts it together. And again, we have a handful of various concerns that we've identified. We use the example of Elm Apple present in a well during the question and answer session. So now let's talk about Elm Apple migrating. We verify that concern and observe that Elm Apple is in fact migrating. So now we need to go into our SMART objective development. Our initial goal is, pretty plainly stated. We want to contain the Elm Apple and reduce the potential for further migration. And we want to do that. We run through a screening process, and we land on a dual-phase extraction, dual-pump liquid extraction, I should say. We're wanting to reduce the mobile Elm Apple mass. And the metric that we're looking at is a stable Elm Apple plume. So really what we're trying to do here is obviously induce a hydraulic control barrier or hydraulic gradient. And there are obviously things that we can do to measure that. But so this is sort of a broadly stated objective of is it moving or not moving. But of course there are deeper layers that we can get into that can help us answer that question. And that, you know, really is looking at, you know, what is the drawdown and have we in fact achieved hydraulic control. So when we put all that together, we have developed that specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely objective. So with that, I'm going to transition briefly to give a tiny preview of what the decision process looks like as it will be described in further detail in the third part. And so this relates to selecting the technology. We haven't really talked about how we select the technology, but within Chapter 6 of the guidance, we identify sort of a phased approach to selecting the technology. And that first phase has to do with establishing your goals and thus sort of breaking apart what are the technology groupings that we have. So we start with 20-some technologies, but as we break them, as we define our goals with the thought of those technology groupings, we reduce to a handful of technologies left to consider. From there, we really want to look at site-specific factors. And here we just generally identify geologic and Elm Apple characteristic factors. But as Andrew and John had identified, there are further detail that can certainly be incorporated into the screening process. Comparative analysis has to do, once we've screened based on our specific site factors, we maybe have just a couple technologies left to review. So simply comparative analysis, I always just think of time and money. If you are money limited, excavation may not very well be something that can be considered. If you're time limited, if it's a development project that you're working on, monitor natural attenuation, again, is something that might not be considered. The point is, within the appendices in the guidance, there are 10 or so different comparative analysis factors that we provide some insight for each of the technologies, and it's helpful to go through this process. The next step would then be to identify what are the critical data needs, and again, that might be the area where the remedy selection and design LCSM really come into play. You know, what specifically do we need to know to understand how well, bioattenuation might be occurring, for example. So we, of course, recommend gathering those critical data needs prior to implementing because, again, doing that up front will lead to implementing a better remedy when that time comes. And then the last step is to select and implement the technology. So in summary, on the decision-making and technology selection, we certainly recommend a systematic decision-making framework, which is something that is put together throughout the document, but largely chapters 5 and chapter 6. And that systematic framework is really based off of a robust and thorough conceptual site model, which has appropriately defined the concerns that we have at the site. We then go through that verification process to make sure that we have those concerns. And if we have concerns that we actively need to manage, we then go about establishing our goals. From there, going through that technology selection process is the next step. And we've discussed how the decision process and conceptual site model development kind of continuously inform each other. And so that's something that, certainly I hope has been impressed upon everyone, that we don't just say, okay, we've got our initial conceptual site model, so now let's go pick our technology and put it in. And then the last component that really leads to project success is having those SMART objectives developed and understood by all stakeholders that are working on the project such that we can really track the progress of where we're trying to get to. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Tom Fox with the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety.
Great. Thank you, Eric. We're near the end of our part two of our training session right now and of the new document. And what we'd like to do is give you a little bit of preview for next week, and that is that we'll be discussing some remedial technology groups. Some of these will be getting into very exquisite detail. We'll be also providing a framework for technology selection more in depth than what we've been through today. We'll also be introducing tools to screen the technologies for use, again, in more detail. We'll introduce performance metrics specifically to optimize your efforts and decide when to stop or transition to another technology. And finally, to help illustrate this whole process a little bit better for everybody, we're going to bring a case study to demonstrate the use of these tools. So during the next week, we'd like to give you a little bit of a homework assignment, I guess, and as to think about one of your sites and what data you have available. And we'd like to go through a short remedy selection LCSM exercise and then to help you select potential remedial technology mechanisms or confirm if the current remedial technology that's chosen is the best one for you. And we're going to be providing some additional insight on these technologies in part three that should help you out quite a bit more. So here is Juliana to wrap everything up for us today.
Thanks, Tom. We are going to have time for maybe one or two questions, so you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. We have a few final poll questions for you as we're finishing up today. On the slide, we have our links to additional resources, so we've talked about several of these things during the class today. This is just a page where we've pulled together some different links. We do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a participation certificate. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. There's also the option, if you have more than one person at your location, for the first person to fill out the feedback form, Once you submit, you can go back and have the next person submit the feedback form as well. So everyone at your location can get a certificate if they're interested. For the poll questions, after today's training, are you ready to develop the LNAPL conceptual site model for LNAPL concern identification? And are you ready to communicate with stakeholders about the decision-making process? Also, to the right, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And as people are answering this question, you can see what other people in the audience are going to do, and you can scroll down to see the different answers as they come in. So we just have a few minutes for questions, so I'm looking for a couple of questions to come in through that Q&A pod. And trainers, if there's a question that's come in that you've already answered that you'd like to answer out loud, let me know, and we can do that.
Juliana, this is Andrew Kirkman, and one of the questions that was asked is someone had heard that benzene is one of those constituents that is generally degrades last. And benzene is perhaps readily degradable relative to all of the different hydrocarbons within petroleum products, such as gasoline or diesel. However, benzene is highly soluble, and it travels well in dissolved phase. So typically, you'll see extended dissolved phase plumes, and it is not as biodegradable, say, as toluene is. And so it will travel further than toluene, and it will be one of those last things you might see in a dissolved phase plume. However, when you're talking about LNAPL source depletion, whether it's through soil vapor extraction, enhanced biodegradation, aerobic, like sparging, adding oxygen to it, or biotin, or even in anaerobic conditions, methanogenesis, iron reduction, there's a lot of different mechanisms for benzene to go away. And it's aerobic, benzene is readily degradable. Anaerobic, sometimes it does vary, but there's typically a lot of mechanisms for it to go away. So in terms of all the hydrocarbons that get in dissolved phase, you could say benzene is one of the most persistent in dissolved phase. In terms of the original oil source, benzene is kind of like a middle-of-the-road biodegradable component of the oil source itself. Hopefully that clarifies things for other people.
Thank you. A couple of people have asked about the certificate, so be sure to fill out the feedback form. And the third item on this slide 91 takes you to that feedback form. We really do use your feedback. At the bottom, check the box to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system is going to make that certificate for you. So a question's come in. So LNAPL transmissivity will change, decline as recovery progresses?
Yeah. LNAPL transmissivity is a function of your gauged oil thickness, the formation permeability, but also what fraction of the pores does oil occupy. So when oil occupies a higher fraction of that pore space or that permeability, you'll get a larger discharge out of a well for a given down. As you recover oil from a finite source, you're reducing that saturation. You're reducing the number of pores oil can flow through. So as you recover, the relative permeability, the number of pores oil is occupying is reduced, the discharge for a given drawdown reduces, and ultimately your transmissivity is reduced. And so you get a what's called a first-order decline. Biodegradation, vapor removal is often a first-order decline too, because you're removing the most volatile components, and as you remove those components, the rate at which volatilization occurs declines as well, and you'll see first-order declines for the both of those. And those are good examples of where spotting recovery rate versus volume removed on a graph gives you a nice linear relationship. Biodegradation is controlled by different factors, not simply by saturation, but by microbial population and a lot of other things that are often more limiting. And biodegradation is often zero order until there's very low TPH concentrations remaining.
Thank you. We are out of time, so if you have a question that we have not addressed or if another question comes along to you, email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with trainers. Trainers' contact information is also available on the CLUIN training page where you started today. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. More information on ITRC is on the website, itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a